The Senate Revenue Committee, good afternoon, especially to our new members. There was some confusion yesterday. You do not have to get a majority of those on your side of the dais to ask a question.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I have a majority at the moment.
You do.
On my side.
You are free to ask away, and Senator Nelson, likewise. Today's a public hearing on House Bill 2152. We may return to this tomorrow morning for a public hearing and possible work session. 9 o'clock is about the ETA on when we will return to this bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2152. Members, you have before you the A9 agreement. That A9 agreement is a product of a group that you as members of the Senate put together. It was comprised of the Senate Caucus Leader Roger Breyer, Senator Harper, Senator Atkinson, Senator Deckard, and Senator Brown. This plan that you have before you is the result of that bipartisan agreement that came out of that group. Mr. Warner, if you want to walk us through the components of it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll ask my staff to come up on to the dais for serve as a panel on the detailed questions. What I thought I would do is walk through the one sheet that's labeled Senate Revenue Plan. You have that in front of you, and then you also have major components of HB 2152 by section. So those two should match in terms of the revenue impacts, and that will allow you to trace back to where the sections are in the bill. The first thing to point out about the bill is that 2152 is an extension of a sunset date on the 10-cent temporary tax on cigarettes. That has been built into the governor's recommended budget, but that without this bill, that 10-cent per pack surcharge would go away on January 1st, 2004. Now, turning to the revenue plan itself, and we have some components listed there that are not actually in this bill. And the federal stimulus grants, of course, are not. There's also two business charges and fees, a securities fee and a corporate filing fee. Those are in, at the moment anyway, in House Bill 3656, which is in the House Revenue Committee right now. The key components of 2152 are under personal income tax. And the first one is a means test on the elderly medical deduction. Oregon, going back to 1991, allows an additional medical deduction for seniors. Originally, the age requirement was 58 years old. This is an additional deduction to the what's allowable on federal returns. This would be for all medical expenses. And that initial bill, the age requirement was increased gradually from 58 to 62, in which it reached 62 in 1999. What the amendment does in 2152 is it applies a means test in which it phases out the amount that can be deducted beginning at $30,000 joint, and then it proportionally reduces it. And it also increases the age eligibility 1 year at a time for the next 3 years, so it goes from 62 up to 65 by the year 2006. So those are the two components in the bill. We estimate that will increase income tax collections by $42 million in the 2003-05 biennium. The second piece is depreciation allowed for SUVs for business purposes. This is a bill you've heard before in 2747, so this comes back to you in this form. The revenue impact has been adjusted for two things. One is that only the Oregon portion is changed by this bill. People would be allowed to take their federal deduction under this under 2152. The impact has gone up for a couple of reasons. One is that it now applies to the 2003 tax year, so it's 03, 04, and 05. And it also has been increased by federal law. If you'll recall, the federal stimulus package that passed in May That increased the allowable expensing from $25,000 to $100,000, and that affected the impact of this provision. So we're now estimating at $4.7
million. Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Should we ask questions as we go along, or do you want to wait to the end?
Paul, it's up to you. I feel fine with giving an answer as we go.
I just had a question about that one. In determining the revenue impact, it seems like if you are taking away the adding back on, you would actually bring in more money to the state because you wouldn't have such a deterrent for people making those purchases. It seems to me that there, if you include that impact on the vehicle purchases, that should increase the estimate of the revenue.
Okay. Let me defer that to Dick because he did the revenue impact on it.
I'm trying to remember that was taken into consideration. I presume you're talking about the fact that the original, the 2747 said that the Oregon addition would be three times
right.
the amount that was taken.
And presumably if it were three times, you would have fewer people making those purchases because they wouldn't be taking advantage of that tax break.
Right. I think the federal tax break is still substantial relative to any Oregon penalty.
Right.
And it's going to be the controlling thing, but certainly as a marginal influence, that would tend to reduce the number of Oregon purchases.
Okay.
But that's simply swamped by the increase at the federal
level. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue on down the list on the personal income tax components. The third one is a capping the federal tax subtraction at $3,000. The tax subtraction had begun to be phased up as a result of special session action the last year. It moved from $3,000 to $3,250 for the 2002 tax year, the returns that were filed this past spring, and then is at $3,500 for the 2003 tax year under current law. What this provision does is move it back to the 2001 level at $3,000 maximum for federal taxes, and it holds it there through until 2006. And then in 2006, it goes to $3,250, 2007 to $3,500, and it back to the schedule that's in current law. So it delays implementation of that phase-in schedule until 2006. The largest component for the personal income tax actually has three elements to it, and is the personal exemption credit. The personal exemption credit for 2002 taxes was $145 per exemption. That has been reduced, and actually the bill says to $125. It is then frozen at that level. Under current law, the personal exemption credit is adjusted for changes in the consumer price index, which has ended up being in the neighborhood of $3 to $4 a year, given the inflation patterns we've seen. This would freeze the 125 exemption credit through until 2006, in which it would be then adjusted for the inflation in the prior year. And it also phases out allowance of the personal exemption credit or tests it for income. That phase-out begins at $90,000 for joint filers, in which there's a proportional reduction, and that proportional reduction increases until you get to $150,000 adjusted gross income for a joint filer or $75,000 single, and then it is no personal exemption credit would be allowed. So it would be eliminated for those high income levels. This provision is a 3-year provision, and then again the phase out would be eliminated beginning in the 2006 tax year. The next piece of the personal income tax changes in 2152 is a suspension of the standard deduction indexing for inflation. This actually, 2003, was scheduled to be the first year in which that would take place as a result of actions you took in the 2001 regular session. And so what this would do is delay implementation of indexing the standard deduction for 3 years. Until 2006, so then it would be implemented, and again it would be adjusted by the 2005 inflation rate. The personal income tax brackets are also indexed, and this goes back to '93, And those brackets, freezing them and not allowing them to be adjusted for changes in the consumer price index would generate about $26 million. And finally, the measure refers to itemized deductions, and they are, reduces them by 5%. It allows 95% of itemized deductions to be taken on Oregon returns, and the 5% temporary reduction applies to 03, 04, and 05 tax years only, and then it's sunsetted. So those are the personal income tax components and the revenue impact there next to them. On the corporate income tax side, there is a, if you look on your major component sheet there, you can see on the second page, gives you those graduated minimum corporate income tax numbers. For C corporations, sales less than $20,000. All of these, of course, now are at $10 under current law. It would go to $325 and then scaled up until you get to the next page above $50 million. You'd have a minimum tax of $10,000. Now, the $50 million refers to Oregon sales. So Oregon sales are defined in the bill. There's also a new graduated minimum tax for S corporations. Begins sales with less than $1 million for those S corporations are $325 minimum, and then that's scaled up to those above $15 million would have a $750 minimum. We estimate that those changes would generate $110 million in the 0305 biennium, and the way the bill is structured now, those changes would be permanent. Another component of the corporate income tax is the extraterritorial income. This is a bill actually that was introduced by the Department of Revenue on the House side, and it has been incorporated into House Bill 2152. It amounts to a disconnection from the federal tax code. In 2000, the federal government passed a law that allowed corporations to exclude income from subsidiaries that are based on exports. They're a device that were designed to encourage export activity by U.S. corporations. The World Trade Organization ruled those in violation of their rules, and that currently is in Congress is currently searching for a way to adjust for that. But what this measure would do is disconnect Oregon from that extraterritorial income provision. And that would generate, we're estimating, $18 million during the biennium. We've also included in this measure is a proportional reduction in corporate credits of 20%. That 20% applies to the 03, 04, and 05 corporate tax years. Those credits can then be carried forward to 06, those that are unused. So it's a three-year temporary suspension of those credits. The bill does exclude the farm workers housing credit and the affordable housing credit from the reduction. So they're unaffected in this round of the bill. The
So Paul, on that, as they're carried forward, could they all be then collected in year 2006 or deducted, I guess, off of the tax liability?
Theoretically, I'll ask Elizabeth to address her assumptions on the revenue impact.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, with that credit, you're supposed to be able to allow it for 3 years to carry forward, beginning in 06. Okay. So if you didn't have tax liability enough to recoup all of those in 1 year, then you could spread it out over 3 years.
Oh, right.
The fourth component there on the corporate income tax is the corporate, there's a subtraction allowed for dividends from corporate subsidiaries. 100% of those dividends are now allowed to be subtracted from Oregon taxable income. This provision reduces the amount subtracted by 25%. In other words, they can subtract 75% of that subsidiary income. And that raises about $19.2 million. That's a little bit different number, Mr. Chair, than you've seen earlier. Actually, we had 18 in there before. We have a more refined estimate of how much that would generate. That is also a three-year temporary change. On the property tax side, the bill addresses the property tax discount, which is currently in Oregon statute, that there's 3% allowed on full payment of property taxes by November 15th. What the bill does is reduce that to 1%, requires, and it applies to the 0405 tax year, not the current property tax year, but to the 0405 tax year. It allows directs the county assessors to compute the difference between what collections would have been at 3% discount versus what they are with a 1% discount, then directs the county treasurers to transfer those dollars to the state treasurer to be deposited in the general fund, two-thirds into the general fund and one-third into the state school fund. So the uses of those funds would be the same as they would under current Measure 5 property tax guidelines.
I've got a procedural question. It's come to my attention at times that when the county assessor collects the dollars from the taxpayer, they go automatically through a formula to be distributed to the small taxing districts that get their collections from the county tax assessor. And the discount would be calculated at that point, and then a portion of that would be set aside and rebated back to the state. Is that sort of the mechanism by which this operates?
That's just what the mechanism would be.
Mr. Chairman, I've been advised, at least with some situations that we have, there are certain funds the county cannot refund from the assessment for collection, for instance, can't be refunded from the county to the taxpayer. And we learned that when the county taxpayers have appealed their assessments and been successful on the appeal, lowering their tax liability, and the county would then be required to rebate the overpayment to the taxpayer, but it cannot refund the assessment. And there are some other places where I wonder if there's going to be difficulty in having the county collect these dollars and then remit these dollars. Have we gone through this with the county assessors to make sure that there's a loop that is practical?
Senator Farioli, we do have Diane Belt here from the county collectors, and she has signed up to. We have been consulted with her, and she's got some other some discussion on that issue.
Okay. Well, just to prove to Diane that I was listening during the other hearings. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And Paul, you talked about the distribution. Once they are, that discount is collected to the state school fund and then to the general fund.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It goes two-thirds to the general fund and one-third to the state school fund. So it would be allocated roughly in the proportions that property taxes currently are allocated. I should also point out that that adjustment is a one-year adjustment only for the 0405 property tax year. Beyond that, what the bill does is establish the Federal Reserve discount rate, which is the rate the Federal Reserve charges its member banks for borrowing from it for short-term funds, as the interest rate to be determined. If that is less than 3%, then the Fed discount rate becomes the governing discount rate for early payment of property taxes. If it's above 3%, it goes back to the current 3% law. So it creates this variable floating rate once 0405 is passed. The 1%, however, is directly specified in the bill. So it would be 1% in that 0405. So that would be a fixed number for that 1 year. The other components of 2152 are consumption taxes there. We've labeled for beer tax, wine tax, and OLCC markup. The beer tax would be an increase of $7.50 a barrel. That would go to the general fund. That $7.50 is broken into two categories, $7.30, which would go to the general fund, and then another $0.20, which would go to establishing a new fund that would that's specified in the bill, a beer marketing fund, as it's referred to in the bill, and that would the role of that board that would govern that and manage that fund would be established in another bill. So there's $7.30 goes general fund. $0.20 goes into that fund. The wine tax increase is actually a little bit more than what we had assumed in our estimates. So the bill calls for increasing the wine tax from by 35 cents, which would move it from 67 cents to $1.02. And our estimates had actually been based on going to a dollar even. So that's a little bit less than what would be generated in our estimates. The only other component in the overall Senate revenue plan that is in 2152 is the medical provider charge for nursing homes. The $12.5 million we have on our sheet there is a transfer to the general fund from the provider charge, and that's specified in the bill itself. The remainder would be used for reimbursing nursing homes for their services, and we have some more detailed discussion on that if the committee desires.
Thank you very much.
Did you already discuss the...
Chair Corcoran.
Paul, did you discuss the lottery discretionary revenue?
I have not discussed that, Senator. That's not a component of this bill, but a component of the revenue plan. There has been a bill introduced in the Senate rules that has a general lottery reference to it. That presumably would be the vehicle to flush that out, and exactly, you know, the specific parts of that would be used to generate the revenue.
And Mr. Chair, the Education Stability Fund. Are there some assumptions made there about the hardiness of that fund being increased by some additional lottery revenue?
Senator, that's correct. The under the current law forecast, the Education Stability Fund would be $108 million. As you recall, the bill that passed through this committee, 3642, about a month and a half ago. This would include another $23 million in additional revenue. The way the bill is written is 90% of the revenue flowing into the Stability Fund after July 1 will go directly to the state school fund in May of 05. So if the amount of lottery revenue goes up, 18% of that will flow right into the state school fund for that transfer. And that $23 million is our estimate. That's consistent with the discretionary lottery you see there, the two components. One is the $59 million up above, and the other is the $8 million down below. By the way, that $57 million in discretionary lottery is consistent with roughly $100 million in overall lottery revenue.
So, Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Senator Parker.
So, I guess, did the methodology to find the additional $23 million include assumptions about, adding another machine, B, the line games, or C, compensation?
Senator, all of those things have been discussed, but right now the numbers that are in there are an assumed amount that can be generated from those kinds of activities. And until we can see those specified in the bill and what those components are, then that would drive towards this estimate.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, the question I have procedurally is, are we going to walk through this downside trigger in addition, or is Paul's completed?
My intention was Paul's completed because that is there for informational purposes, but it's not a part of 2152.
Okay. May I ask a question about it?
Please.
I don't know, maybe this is more appropriate to Dexter or somebody, but... I have some concerns about the legality of using PERS savings from other fund agencies and moving those into basically the general fund. Was there discussion either in the work group about this, or have we sought any kind of information from Dallas or anybody else in legislative council about this?
I'll give you the best answer I can on that, Senator. Ken Rocco, I think, would be the one in ways the LFO would be the best place to obtain information. But the answer that they provided to our work group was that, yes, you can get the money. They didn't weigh in on the whether they would advise it or not, but yes, that 48 is a real number that they can get their hands on, and it's just it's just later in the biennium that they could do it, and we would need to make statutory change to do that, and I believe legislation has been drafted, but that would be done in Ways and Means, not in this committee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
That's really been a very interesting discussion. I appreciate Paul going through all this. But, my God, when I look at this thing, I mean, we as senators ought to be ashamed that we're even looking at this thing. Can you imagine, the audience, look at this stuff in here. This is so complicated and convoluted. Well, we got to come up with a better plan than this. Potentially it has to do something. But from my viewpoint, this thing causes so much problems. You go from personal income tax standard deduction to federal tax things to corporate tax things to personal property tax to wine tax to beer tax and long-term care provider taxes. How in good conscience can we even consider anything like this? Really, honest. I'm just at a loss. I really am.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
It would beg the question of how you could consider, the deaths that we've seen with the lack of services available because of the lack of revenue, too. So a good conscience is a good conscience. Mm-hmm. It has to be looked at in several ways.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to that. It's not that I'm against looking at potential revenue increases, but this is an absolute aberration. My God, for us to even be considering it is just, it's unconscionable from my viewpoint. So I guess you know where I stand. And I don't mean that personally to anybody.
It's a good comment.
Why are we doing this?
Appreciate the comment. The product that you have before you really is of two things. One is that, and I think most importantly, members of this committee, it balances. The final figure on the worksheet is that it gets you a balanced budget, which was the bipartisan agreement that we had with Senator Beyer, Senator Harper, Senator Atkinson, myself, and Senator Brown. But I think the other point that should be made is that we really took the House plan, the plan that the House had been working on, and used that as a template for this. And so 80 to 90% of items that you see before you are items that were a part of the House plan, and this just modifies them a little bit to get to the Senate budget figures of the budgets that I guess we have agreement to.
Mr. Chair, let me respond back. I don't want to get in that argument. I'm not sure that there was ever a budget agreement. I'm not going to get in that. But I'm just saying there is a better way to do this. There's more than one way to skin a cat. And I just think for us to be considering this package as it presented us today is we're not doing our job if we do that.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
If you want to simplify it, we could just say 50% of the delay the Bush tax break for the wealthy for 2 years and save 50% of that, and that'd get us the whole shooting match. We wouldn't have to go through all this.
Did you guys have anything else that would further? I know you don't want to weigh in on the debate you see raging. Anything else on the technical or any other questions for the panel about the technicalities of any parts of 2152? Thank you very much, Dr. Yates. I know you're eagerly awaiting retirement. He gets to retire the day we adjourn. He's going to be awfully old by then.
I guess you don't care about the successor plan, Dr. Yates. You, too, can have a defined contribution plan of your successor. We will take care of you, buddy. We'll gradate it by height.
Paul Romaine, Jim Bruneau, Ms. Fermat from Full Sail Brewing, and Mr. Is it Ockert? Ockert. Please come up.
We have a spare single chair.
Do you want to do the beer first, and then Mr. Bruneau will do the wine?
Wine ages better. We can have the beer is perishable. We've got to get right to it.
I will be doing a lot of whining, so
that's okay. Sure.
afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those few who are left, we've bored you already. My name is Paul Romaine. I'm the executive director and legal counsel for the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And I know this will come as a surprise to you, but we're opposed to the tax provisions on beer and wine in this particular measure. Let me give you just a little bit of background. First of all, I just want it on record for purposes that may come about that we object to any new revenue source starting in the Senate. We think it's unconstitutional. And I realize there is a debate over that, but just for the record. To the merits, I've been representing the beer and wine distributors since 1983, the end of 1983. Seen a lot of changes in that industry since then. The most notable change in the wholesale side is a reduction in the number of people in the business. Most notable change in the manufacturing side is an absolute blossoming of the number of people in the business. In beer and in wine. You have in this state, I believe it's the either third or fourth largest wine-growing region in the country, you have the number one microbrewing industry in the entire country. And there's a couple of things. There's one major thing that accounts for that, aside from the wonderful people who are involved in it. The thing that accounts for it is the fact that you had low taxes. All your major production states, the ones where the breweries started, have the lowest taxes in the country. That's Wisconsin with Miller, Missouri with Anheuser-Busch, and Colorado with Coors. We have 10% of the market, at least 10%, some would even say it's higher than that, is Oregon. The Oregon market is Oregon-produced micro beer. That's an enormous figure when you consider that the next closest state is about 5%, and the state, the average around the country, I think, is around 1% of home state production. And the reason that is the case is it's easy for people to get into the market. It's easy for them to actually start a brewery and to survive and to make money. You'll hear from Mr. Bruneau in the wine area afterwards, and you'll hear from the folks from Full Sail in Bridgeport about the beer area, so I won't go into details on that. Except to say that they are an incredible Oregon success story. Within the wholesale industry, our average wage and benefit package in the beer industry and wine industry, beer and wine distributor, is about $50,000 per year. That's a family wage job. These are not minimum wage jobs. These are things that employ people. We have distributorships all over the state of Oregon. We used to have more, but it's become more and more expensive to stay in business, and you need to consolidate to do so. We still have distributorships in John Day and Burns and Portland and Medford and Pendleton, but it's becoming more and more consolidated because the cost of business goes up, and you can't pass that on. That's more stuff you'll hear from folks. The low beer tax, it's very difficult right now. Through May, our beer sales in Oregon were down 10%. We don't have the figures yet for June or July, and they probably ticked up in July because it got warm again. But our sales are down 10%. That's not the time to be adding additional costs to the business. It doesn't work. I'm used to talking forever, and I can talk forever even if I don't know anything about the subject. So I will basically stop here and let Irene and Carl kind of give you a history of the beer industry from their standpoint, and then maybe add some color commentary when they're finished. Thank you.
Committee members, Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. My name is Carl Okert. I'm the brewmaster of the Bridgeport Brewing Company, which has been making craft beers in Oregon for 20 years now. We're now Oregon's oldest brewery. I've seen the growth of our company rise from 975 barrels in our first year to an anticipated sales figure of 40,000 barrels this year. We support the Oregon economy in many ways. We're part of an economic web. The breweries in this in the state, turn their money, get their money, and turn their money back into the state economy. We're direct employers. We've gone from one employee, who was me, to 90 employees now. We have we pay half of these people family wages, full-time benefits, full benefits, $2.5 million annual payroll. We support Oregon agriculture by purchasing tens of thousands of pounds of hops grown on fields 10 minutes away from here. We buy hundreds of thousands of pounds of Oregon barley that's grown down in the Klamath Falls Basin. All the little bottles that you put in the bottle machines over at the grocery stores, those brown bottles, get turned into other bottles, and we buy those. Deschutes buys them, Wholesale buys them, we buy them, Miller Brewing Company buys them. Those are made at the glass company over there by the Portland Airport. And those are people that are earning family wage jobs. They put them in boxes that are made by people in Northeast Portland. Those are family wage jobs. When we expand our brewery and we put millions of dollars into our brewery, we buy our tanks from a company in Canby, Oregon. Those are family wage jobs. It's all part of that web. It's all part of that recycling that goes on, that happens when a healthy local business is allowed to do what they do best and grow and expand. Part of what we do is we return back to the community, and Bridgeport supports the Oregon Symphony. It supports the Portland Literary Arts. We've done at least a half dozen or better school fundraisers and auctions this year to try to help those folks. We give to the Red Cross, the World Affairs Council. We've given we give usually about $30,000 a year is budgeted for contributing back into the community. And this comes at a time when most companies are cutting back on what they give back to the community. In 2002, we paid $56,000 in Oregon beer tax. There's no loopholes for those taxes. Those are paid. We paid $240,000 in U.S. federal beer taxes. That's $300,000, a burden to our business that doesn't go into reinvestment. It doesn't go into higher wages. It doesn't go into perfecting our business. It goes to the government to help pay our way. A $7.50 per barrel tax would add $150,000 of annual burden onto our business. We're in a difficult situation because when you increase the cost of doing business, you can either pass that along in the form of higher prices, which will decrease your sales. Even we science majors were forced to take some business classes in college, and I think I got that far anyway. Increase your price, decrease your sales. Or we can eat that and add $150,000 of loss to our business, our burden, our profitability. That's sort of a no-win situation for us. And as a small, vibrant, growing business that's continually reinvesting in ourselves to grow and to employ and to build, there's not a lot of places to run there for us. We're against increases in the Oregon beer excise tax because we think it singles out and harms our industry in particular. It hurts us directly in the form of higher costs of doing business. It makes continued investment in our Oregon company less attractive. And it hurts us indirectly by hurting our business partners, who are the Oregon wholesalers. These are the people that bring our beer to market. We don't sell our beer directly. We can't. These are our partners, and we're bringing another burden onto their business. And what hurts them hurts us. So, in summary, I urge you not to hurt or harm this vibrant industry, that we've got a growing industry, a healthy industry, that helps the Oregon economy in many, many ways. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your testimony. I think you said that if this bill passed, you would have to pay increased Oregon beer excise tax of $150,000?
Yes. That's based on $7.50 per barrel times our last year's sales, which was approximately 22,000 barrels in the state.
Uh-huh. Could you give me some, you said you have 90 employees.
Yes.
Could you give me some estimate as to the financial size of your company in terms of payroll, in terms of gross receipts?
Our payroll is about $2.5 million per year annually. I don't know the gross receipts. Unfortunately, I'm in the production side here.
Yeah,
I was asked to come and give testimony, but I don't have all those details.
I mean, I'm just trying to understand whether the $150,000. I mean, to some people, that's more than they make. To others, they won't even feel it. And so but how do I know that? Everybody comes and testifies, they'll feel it.
Yeah.
How do I know that? Yeah, sure.
I'm the CEO, so I don't have revenues.
You can answer the questions.
Yes,
he can't.
Revenues, and for a full sale, it's going to be $175,000 a year,
okay.
And we're an $11 million company with a $2.2 million payroll. We will feel it.
We just need to get your name.
Okay.
I know.
No problem. Irene Fermat, and I'm the CEO and founder of Full Sail Brewing Company.
So your gross receipts are about $11 million.
Yes.
And this would hit you about $175,000.
Yes. And, you know, basically it's a 400% tax increase. And one of the things is it makes it at $10.10 a barrel, it makes it a higher tax rate than what we pay in Washington, California, Colorado, the three other markets that we do a lot of business in. All of us, Oregon craft brewers, invest the most in our local market, and partly in great deal to the fact that we make more money in Oregon because of the way the tax rate is. It means there's more jobs created here and more investment in the community. That would change. I would look at that and say, can we continue to invest the most in a market where we don't make the most money? Wouldn't it make more sense to increase staffing in California or Washington and reduce staffing in Oregon? That's a painful decision to have to make, but as business people, we would have to look at that.
What's the gallonage for California and Washington? I was told by someone in your industry that this would keep it basic parity. Obviously, we'd be still one of the lowest in the nation, but with other producing states, we would
California right now is about, I want to say, 640?
620.
And Washington is about 808.
And does the sales tax that those states have make a difference?
Sales tax is across every product, so I think it's viewed differently by the consumer, because what happens is you go to buy a six-pack of beer, and you see that it's $6.49. You know, we got price point, and that's what the consumer responds to. At the end of the whole process, their entire grocery bill of $100 gets taxed to what proportion it is. It isn't direct price increase, which is why we are so vulnerable and so worried. We are at the very high end of premium pricing. So what we've already seen is that there is a lot of price sensitivity on this product. We're not immune to it. People love us, but not that much. And if you're talking about going from $7.69 and the 3 cent per drink, you, at least I know the barrel thing, and I understand it is hard, even though it is a production tax, and that's the way we view it, at least multiply it by six, because people buy beer in a six-pack. So we're really talking 18, 20 cents a six-pack, and then marked up through the system. You're talking about a product that is hovering just below $8. We believe it's going to put us above $8. If we ask anybody, honestly, how much of our beer will you buy at $8, it'll become a very special occasion product instead of the everyday luxury that is how we were all building our companies.
Yes, sir.
Senator Ringo.
Just to follow through with that, I didn't follow your math there.
Sure.
Right now, a six-pack is, you said, $6.49?
Oh, when it's on sale. Really, day in, day out, we're averaging about $7.69. When we put it on sale, which is, and you see the ads from the grocery stores and stuff, but day in, day out, our packaging hovers around $7.49, $7.69, $7.89.
And if you were to take that, the $175,000 tax increase and pass it all the way through to the consumer, then that would mean a price increase per six-pack of 18 cents?
No, because that's assuming no markups through the distributor network or the retailer.
Yeah, okay, but that's what I want to understand.
Sure.
So you're saying that if there's a tax increase, that may cause additional markups through the distribution system?
Yes.
Now, why is that?
Because all of our wholesalers as well as our retailers work on a percentage markup. They have a percentage margin that they decide, like any business does, what they need to cover their costs.
But explain to me why the bump on the tax
because
causes an additional markup.
It's not a tax from their point of view, and I think that's a really key thing here. It is a production cost. It is a tax that the breweries pay for production, not for it is not a sales tax, and it is not something that we do at any other point in the process. It adds totally to our cost of goods sold. I mean, that's where it is on our financial statement. This is how we view it. And so what happens is, as a distributor, what you're seeing is that a case of Full sale all of a sudden goes up this amount. We're not going to mark it up. But then the cost of their product for carrying it, for inventory, for financing, they put their margin on it. Then it goes to retail, which also puts margin on it.
Well, I don't want to beat this further, I guess, but I still don't understand why an increased tax at one end will cause more than that tax at the other end.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Farioli.
If I understand this, basically your wholesalers and retailers only look at unit cost.
Right.
So and they only look at unit cost. They don't care how you get to the unit. They just look at the unit cost.
Right, and they don't say, I'm going to make $2 a case. They say, I'm going to make 25% a case. And so if the case goes from costing $15 to $15.20, their unit costs went up.
So it wouldn't matter, Mr. Chairman, if we taxed hops. And it wouldn't matter if we taxed grain.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't matter if we taxed cartons or bottles. Because the unit...
It's all part of the cost.
That the wholesaler buys this case.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, just a little color commentary for Senator Ringo. What happens at the wholesale level, again, we, with beer that's produced in Oregon, the tax is put on at the brewery level. With beer that's imported into the state, other micros from around the country or the major breweries, we are the point of taxation. And all these things, that an excise tax is a great tax from a political standpoint because the consumer never sees the tax. It's not at the end of the bill like a sales tax is. But it's a horrible tax from a consumer being consumer-friendly because it's literally marked up through the system. It just becomes, as Senator Farioli was saying and others were saying, it becomes a cost of acquisition of the product, the federal tax and the state tax. So if it's $10 that we paid, we don't care whether that was the bottle, the hops, the barley, or the tax, that's $10. We don't sit there and run the tax separately through each little bit. We mark it up 20-25% depending on where it's being sold and how it's being sold, and then it goes to the retailer, who again does not take into consideration, there's no separate line item. Mm-hmm. They mark it up another 25-30% or so. So by the time the consumer sees that tax, it's not the tax amount. It becomes a tax that's marked up, you know, probably as much as 50%.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, if that's true, then people are making money off the markup along the way.
Right. Of course, but isn't that right? So, as a business, I mean, as a company, I figure out what our net profit should be, and we're 100% employee-owned. So for us, the shareholder value matters, and the profit goes back into our employees and our company. But every company runs on saying, I have a margin I need to do to cover my cost. Yes. If we don't hit our gross margin percentage, we're losing money. It's no different for the distributor. It's no different for the retailer.
But it's also on that point about everybody's making money. Yes, everybody's making money through the system as you mark the tax up, but a distributor is different than a producer. A producer will have, say I have a distributorship that sells Bridgeport and Full Sail, and they have a couple of packages that come to me. I also have some other brands from other areas, other states, and I have brands that fill a whole bunch of different price points. So if the fact that my high-end $7.99 beer now has to be $8.29 to the consumer, doesn't affect me that much. I might sell less of Irene's beer, but I'll sell more of somebody else's beer who hits that price point. So you end up with the Oregon brewery, who is really focused at the more high-end market with their production. It's obviously some of the greatest beer, if not the greatest beer in the world, is produced right here. It's a high-end market. They get hurt a lot from a tax increase.
Senator Metzger.
Well, I actually had a couple questions for Irene, but I think she, Irene, got to jump in and answer a question, but we never really got to your prepared discussion. So I'd like to maybe have Irene have an opportunity to maybe fill in some things that you wanted to give to us as instead of just reacting to our questions first. And then I did have a couple questions for you.
I think that's pretty much it. I know that you're all exhausted and you're hearing so many different people, so I don't want to overburden with too much information. I think the biggest thing is just to show you how genuinely concerned we are for our companies.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to answer any questions.
I do have a couple of
things.
Senator Metzger.
And I appreciate you coming, Irene. Of course, this is in my district, and they do, and Full Sail is one of my favorites, so I put that on the record.
Not the favorite?
Well, the favorite, yes.
Okay.
How did I slip that out?
No, no.
You mentioned neighboring states. I'm curious, from your own standpoint, how do you view the strength of the Washington microbrew market?
I think that's a really different market in a lot of ways than us. They didn't grow the same sort of groundswell of companies, and they have two very large individual players that rose early on and were able to get financing at a different level than most other smaller craft beers. So it has a really different dynamics than Oregon. Oregon is so homegrown and so much, it's such a large percentage of the total market.
The follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, is that, and Paul was mentioning about in the dialogue here about the different excise taxes, and I believe you articulated correctly the neighboring states in Washington is 808, mm-hmm. which they pay on a state level. Mm-hmm. And the proposal in House Bill 2152 makes that 1020 here in Oregon. And I just was, you know, if this fee mm-hmm. that Oregon brewers paid was below the Washington figure of 808, mm-hmm. if it was mm-hmm. less than that, mm-hmm. What would that do competitively, if any change at all? Because you talked about how most breweries market regionally. How would that impact you?
I think it weakens us as companies. I mean, there's no way you can get around it that we either have to flow it through and see what happens when the prices increase, or say for us it's $175,000 out of our company, which means $175,000 less for reinvestment to make us more efficient or to invest more in the marketplace. And I think one interesting thing about Washington, if you take a look, the two largest companies are public. They both lose money. And they have the luxury of doing that, one of them because they're partially owned by Anheuser-Busch, and the other one because in a public offering they raise quite a bit of money. That isn't true for me. That isn't true for you. It's not true for Deschutes or for just about any other craft brewery. So it is I can tell you we're profitable because we'd be out of business. And I think that if the tax rate has done that to nurture these local businesses, hasn't that been an enormously smart tax decision? Mm-hmm. We're 2,600 jobs, and I think, frankly, I probably have a skewed view, but in some ways we're like the ultimate PR for Oregon, mm-hmm. the wineries and the breweries.
I have one last question, mm-hmm. Chair. And then any of you, our two in the field folks, perhaps for sure, is at what price of the excise tax, which is currently what, $2.60 mm-hmm. here in Oregon, mm-hmm. At what price does that become problematic? In other words, things change all the time. It hasn't gone up in many, many years. Is it a dollar? Is it $2? What is the price point for the excise tax that then would change the competitiveness that you see of your industry?
It's very difficult to tell you that any increase in cost that we could not control would be a positive thing for Full Sail. As Paul was saying, the industry hasn't been in decline. It's been very competitive, and we have managed to find cost saving after cost saving to go beyond that. This is a cost that would just get thrown on us. Even at the smallest rate, you're talking $50,000 to $100,000. Our employees work incredibly hard to find $100, $500 in savings. So in so many ways, it's a devastating sensation to feel like you're working so hard to survive in this economy, and then you get bombarded with some additional costs that there's nothing that we could do to make that back. And that is really money out of our company, and for us, it's money out of our employees' shares value, which at the end of the day is what their retirement plan is going to be.
Mr. Chair, if I might ask Irene to just... She didn't tell you about the history of Full Sail, because I think we got a little bit interrupted, but it's a very unique history in this state. They're employee-owned.
We're employee-owned. We started in 1987, and unlike Carl's, who did a whole, I was impressed, 700 barrels, we did 257 in our first year. So we do 60,000 barrels right now, plus we were just really thrilled to sign a contract to bring some of Henry's being brewed back in Oregon. So we're about 90,000 barrel brewery. And in 1999, in order to avoid a buyout that basically would have shut down the brewery in Hood River, which is 60 jobs in Hood River, which matters in a county and a city that size, we put together an employee buyout, which means that the employees bought 60% of the company. My husband and I own the other 40%. And we took a loan out to do that at a high level of financial risk that also set certain expectations on profitability going forward. It really is no different in some ways than what Gary Fish is doing down at the Deschutes, where he's borrowed $15 million to grow his business, believing that certain things will stay the same. No guarantee about that in business. And believe me, after running a business for 16 years, I understand that. But to have it come from your own state government, that lack of security is pretty brutal for us. So,
Mr. Chair, in the House committee when we had testimony last week, one person who couldn't be here today was Kurt Widmer, who with Widmer Brewing Company. And he made a very interesting point. Widmer has about half dozen temporary employees on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to put them on full-time, but he's not going to. He'd put them on full-time after you all leave, assuming you don't do too much damage to us, or any damage, hopefully. But it's one of those precarious situations. The Oregon beer market is very saturated with very good microbrews. It's hard to grow your business here. You have to really watch your cost, and that's what they're trying to do. And they're doing a heck of a job. We just finished the Oregon the microbrewing festival. It brought in about 80,000 people
mm-hmm.
per day.
Mm-hmm.
It was enormous. You all probably got a few calls from people at that festival. But it's something we're known for in this state. And again, like all of the home states for major beer production, it's a low tax state. That's the key to being able to stay in business and do well. And we would urge you in the beer side to not raise a tax. I do want to comment a little bit on the wine side because I limited my comments to beer, but we also represent beer and wine. Before Mr. Bruneau gets up here, if I might, or if you're finished with the beer.
Yeah, we are. Are we finished with the beer?
I never got a
started one.
we can make arrangements if you want.
Paul, I'd like to, Senator Farrelly, and I believe our other Republican colleagues have a caucus, and I'd like, Senator Farrelly has a question on the property tax, so I'd like to bring up our property tax person. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for expanding your businesses in Oregon and understand your opposition to this bill. Ms. Belt and Mr. Bartholomew, could you come up and answer a question or two? And do you have prepared comments that you wanted to make, or you're just available?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also employed by Washington County. Just a couple comments, because this we also kind of worked with this on the House side, so kind of had an idea of what was coming up. I did have an opportunity to contact several of the counties to find out what kind of an impact this would make, and I think the biggest concern was in programming, and a lot of it had to do with the floating discount rate. And I think most counties' feeling was if you pick a number between 0 and 3 and stick with it.
Okay.
And there's 9 counties in particular that are small counties on a specific programming system that it would be a huge expense to them for the reprogramming. And so that bothers them a little bit. But as far as being able to implement something like this, it would be something that we would be able to do. Can't guarantee you how the funds would come in because it's hard to predict how people would pay when they're, you know, the 3% discount has always been kind of a popular thing. If you lower it to 1%, I don't know. People like Intel and other folks like that, the large payers, they're the ones that would probably sway it one way or the other if they're going to take advantage of that discount or just go to the trimester payments. To answer your question, Senator Farrelly, I'm glad you were listening. The example, and let me see if I'm understanding what you were trying to talk about. Let's say we have a taxpayer that had a $100 tax and they chose to pay it in full and received their 1% discount, which would have been a dollar. So we received $99. So that means that $2 we're going to pull out of our distribution to the districts and send that off to the state. So the state got $2 and the districts took a dollar hit, the rest of the districts. So now this taxpayer appealed and they were adjudicated a lower value that actually ended up lowering their tax. So now their tax should have been $50. So when we do the correction, that means that their discount allowed was 50 cents. So if I send a bill to the state for a dollar, are we going to get it back?
Why are you looking at me?
I think it's over a dollar. Didn't we pass a bill that had to be at least a dollar to be refunded? I think we did.
Yeah, well, I think it's more than that. So I guess basically what I would assume, Senator Farrelly, what would happen in this case would be that the Department of Revenue would have to produce a rule to tell us how to handle these types of situations. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're looking at large industrial refunds or utility refunds, it could be a fairly large sum of money. So it would be something that you definitely, when you're looking at this plan, you would have to look at.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly.
Is there not an assessment also that the county remits to the state for other purposes, for administrative overheads?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, it's not an assessment. It's a portion of the interest. Our interest rate is 16%. 4% of that goes back to the Department of Revenue to be distributed back to the counties to fund assessment and taxation, along with some recording fees. They call it the A&T fund, but that has to do with the interest. It doesn't have anything to do with the discount.
Okay. And are there no other mandatory funds that are attached to the assessment and taxation process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't believe so.
Okay. I was just concerned about the mechanics, Mr. Chairman. I think they're, it sounds very simple to collect the total amount of taxes to keep 1% and then to remit the 2% to the state. But the things that sound simple here are often look addled in implementation. And I just want to make sure that we're consulting with folks in the 36 county assessor departments that have to do it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, we appreciate that. And I, like I say, I think part of the biggest comment I got was basically that the floating rate, and it had to do with the fact that we already have a very complex system in Measure 50, and this is going to add another layer of complexity to try to explain to a taxpayer. And that's why, I mean, it was very resounding from the people that contacted me, which was probably more than half, is, you know, pick a number and we'll stick with it. And that would be much easier for programming to explain to the customer, and also for corrections and that kind of stuff, so that you don't have a table where you're looking at a year. And then the other issue that we kind of talked about was, is it going to be 1.67 one year, then 1.85 or two? So that's something for you to ponder, but we can handle it. Mm-hmm. We can do it.
And does your gut give you any insight into what that number? We talked a while about this variable Fed discount rate versus the 3% and what the number would be. We kind of settled on 1.5. I don't know if you have thought or comment if we went back from the variable to a 1.5.
Did you? Yeah, Gary, I think Gary can.
Gary Bartholomew, representing Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors and employed at Multnomah County. Chair Deckert, I think I testified to this committee on an earlier bill, and I think I mentioned these rates of return on the discount that we have now. A 3% discount is equivalent to a 12% rate of return. So if you can put your money in the bank and earn more than 12% annual, then you should pay your taxes in third if you have the money, you know, to do that. Mm-hmm. So if we go to I think this bill is going to a 1% rate, that would effectively be a 4% rate of return. So I do wonder how many citizens will still take advantage of the discount. I think mortgage companies will still pay in full as long as there's any discount at all. And just some rough numbers, we think it's about a third of our accounts that are paid with mortgages, and probably only around maybe 25% of the revenue that comes in. So the other 75% would be where there's a discretion on the part of many of them, businesses and so forth, to look at their cost of capital and so forth, determine whether they would pay in full.
But, Mr. Chair, as far as the federal rate at this time, I'm not sure what it is. I think John Phillips from the Department of Revenue had some figures on that.
It's 1.5.
Is it 1.5?
Mr. Chairman, a question completely off the topic, Mr. Chairman, to the Multnomah County representative. Have you figured out how to pay for the meander survey on the Sandy and how you're going to rebate those taxes to the citizens on the Sandy River?
I don't know anything about that.
You probably don't want to.
Probably wants to look into the navigability declaration on the Sandy.
Thankfully, we're just collectors, not assessors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions for the panel that we have before us? Or does anyone want to plug any of their other bills that they have voted through while we... Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, it's regrettable, but we have a meeting that we... At least I have a meeting I need to attend. I'm going to go to that meeting.
Yeah.
I thought I might have, you know, the, yeah, six or one or half a dozen of the other. Yeah, 125 is better. I got it.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Bruneau. I appreciate you, and Mr. Romaine, and Sandra Bishop. You want to talk about wine also? Give us a yeah. No, please come up and grace us.
Mr. Chair, Paul Romaine again, for the record. On the wine side, you have a very interesting wine tax structure in this state. I should say we have a very interesting wine tax structure in this state. Basically, we tax some, we don't tax others. Originally, we had a gallon, or we exempted all Oregon vineyard or wineries from a tax. That was obviously unconstitutional, so in the early 80s, it was changed to a gallonage exemption, which is somewhat problematic. But basically, in the state of Oregon right now, with wine tax, any domestic producer, and it's important to remember domestic producer for something that that Paul mentioned earlier, with GATT, but any domestic producer producing less than 100,000 gallons a year is exempt from the first 40,000 gallons sold in the state of Oregon. Translated, what that means is the person sitting to my right, Jim Bruneau, who's the largest wine producer in the state, pays the tax, as do about three or four other folks in the state, but nobody else in the state of Oregon pays tax here. Some of your most profitable wineries in the world, in California and Washington State, boutique wineries, pay no tax in the state of Oregon because they fall within that exemption. You also have, it does tax foreign wines, but again, you may have a GATT problem with taxation of foreign wines and no taxation of domestic wines. Hasn't been brought up, but it's a very real issue. Everybody sort of just ignores it most of the time. Second of all, mail order. You have a system set up which is great for the Oregon wine growers. It allows them to mail out. But basically, if you bring in wine by mail from another state, the state of Oregon gets no tax from it. So you've set up a system where the only people really paying tax is a poor schmo who goes to a local store to buy the wine that happens to be at that local store that's produced by a bigger winery, basically. The system is just not set up very equitably. Now, you're adding to the burden to Mr. Bruneau and others, and now 35 cents a gallon, which is about a 60%? 52% increase in the tax. And I think Mr. Bruneau and Ms. Bishop, representing California, can basically explain more of that to you. But I just wanted to let you know that the system is a little weird here for wine tax.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association and also the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards, located just south of Salem. Mr. Chairman, I did hear that you did listen to the testimony that was given in the House, and I appreciate that very much. So I will be brief. I think the craft brewers did an excellent job of explaining the business effects of an increased cost like this to us. The first thing is that my competitors, for example, in California, have a lot more money to pound us over the head with because they pay a 20 cents a gallon tax. Now, it's true in Washington they pay a higher tax, but they have higher yields, much higher yields that they get from their fruit. So the margins, the gross margins that are available to us as Oregon wine producers are much smaller than they are as a result of that. For myself, now when you go down to buy one of my bottles of Riesling in the grocery store for $7.99, I have to compete with U.S. Tobacco. U.S. Tobacco owns San Michel, Stimson Lane, Columbia Winery. And they make millions of cases of wine, and they buy glass in huge volumes, and they get much cheaper prices than I do, which means that, first of all, there's no way I can pass on this increased cost to the consumer, ultimate consumer, through higher prices, because I'd be giving up what market I have to U.S. Tobacco and Stimson Lane. And
Mr. Trump,
Senator Ringo.
We talked about the beer, the 18 cents a pack. What if you were to pass it along? What would it be per bottle?
I didn't calculate that, although I could, because there's no way I can pass it on. It's impossible for me to do it. Okay. Oregon wine sales, for the first time in Oregon history, declined last year. Prices are falling in our industry that we get for our products, although our costs are rising because glass is getting more expensive because of the cost of electricity, and distribution's rising because of the cost of diesel fuel. So we're in an unusual situation for the first time where our costs are going up, but our prices are falling. So it wasn't even worth it for me to calculate what I would have to try and figure out. There's no way I could do it. I think you know that the way this exemption works, there is a small producer exemption, and if you think about it, the Oregon legislature really was, in hindsight, remarkably effective in what they did. Over a period of 35 years, there is now 550 commercial vineyards in Oregon, almost 200 commercial wineries employing several thousand people, paying millions of dollars in taxes. There's $250 million invested in vineyards and wineries in Oregon, 10,500 acres of land that people thought was marginal land that wasn't even good for farmland is now producing some of the highest valued crops in Oregon. If you take Oregon wine grapes and you add the cost, the value of producing it and making it into wine, Oregon wine now ranks among the top 10 agricultural products produced in Oregon. It really is an amazing success story. And you did it through the policies that you adopted as our industry began. And the Californians came up from California to make wine in Oregon. And, of course, this certainly does reverse that. The way the exemption works is you get a 40,000-gallon exemption as long as you sell less than 100,000 gallons in Oregon. Now, Willamette Valley Vineyard sells more than 100,000 gallons in Oregon. Therefore, I don't get the exemption at all. But there's a number of Oregon wine producers, certainly more than the three or four, the five that Paul Romaine mentioned, but there's many Oregon wineries in Oregon that are above the 40,000-gallon exemption. So they're paying tax on the sales of wine above that 40,000-gallon exemption. They just have the advantage of it. I lose it because I'm over 100,000. So it is kind of a goofy way that the law works. We actually, several sessions ago, asked you to raise the exemption, the threshold that you'd lose the exemption on. But the problem was that you'd lose way too much revenue by increasing it, let's say, to 200,000 gallons. Mm-hmm. You've had some great questions, I brought my financial statements with me. I have them here. And the reason why I can bring them and show them and tell you about them is because we're a public company. We're Oregon's only publicly held winery. And it was a very unusual winery because I started it myself as a public company, sold the shares myself, got the SEC approval, actually with the help of a couple of great lawyers in Portland, and got on the NASDAQ myself. And if you can go online and you actually read my financial statements. But I thought I'd tell you, here's what I did last year. I did $6 million in sales. And I produced income before taxes of $535,500 approximately. And you'd say, Jim, you know, that's pretty good. I mean, it's a little under 10%, but that's okay. But then deduct this. Deduct $88,000 in local property taxes. Deduct $117,000 in federal wine taxes. Deduct $74,000 in Oregon wine tax. $11,000 in the alcohol license fees I need to pay to be in business, and about $1,500 that I have to pay to, like, the EQ and Department of Ag and so on. So by the time I'm done paying those taxes, I've got $242,000 left. Then I pay a combined federal state rate of about 40% corporate income tax. So on $6 million in sales, 100 employees working, $7 million of equity at risk, $7 million worth of borrowed money, I produced a net income of $146,000. Now, the prior year, 2001, I did $59,000 net income. 2000, I broke even. In 1999, I lost money. In 1998, I lost money. In fact, our level of profitability is so low, you can go on and look at my financial statements, and you'll read a very alarming statement in them, which is that my lender, which has loaned me a lot of that $7 million, Farm Credit Services, has placed me in violation of my loan covenants. That gives them the right to take the assets of the winery at any time. Now, they have given me a waiver now for the last 4 years, annually, a written waiver on the violation of those loan covenants. And the loan covenants are on low profitability. So the problem, so every time I meet with them to go over these issues, I say, well, what's the legislature going to do about the taxes? Because they know what happens. They know that money will have to come out of the business and reduce my profitability and create a likelihood that they may end up running the winery. Now, here's a company that's owned by, over 4,000 Oregonians, employs, over 100 Oregonians, sells wine all over the world proudly, and is in financial peril and has been for a long time because our business is very marginal. Now, all the rest of the Oregon wineries won't tell you this story, probably. They'll tell you some of the details, but they're proud families and proud owners. We have a few celebrity owners that I think sometimes color people's view. I mean, certainly, Governor Neil Goldschmidt now owns a vineyard. Bob Pamplin, an industrialist, a very wealthy man, bought Chateau Man Michel. But really, our industry is made up of farmers. I mean, what we make is what we grow and what we produce, and that is all we have. And so this is extremely onerous and difficult for us to figure out how we would manage through.
Thank you very much, Mr. Renaud. Questions or comments? Appreciate your testimony. I listened to it in the House, and I did appreciate what you had to say. Ms. Bishop.
Thank you, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Bishop. For the record, I represent the Wine Institute. The Wine Institute is the California marketing group for the wineries of California. We represent about 450 of the some 700 some. It's hard to keep track. They keep buying each other out, and the big ones are buying the small ones. So it's hard to keep track of exactly how many, but upwards of somewhere over 700. The reason I'm here today testifying is that the same issues in California are the Oregon issues, and that is that about 80% of the wineries in California are small agricultural operations. Before Senator Ringo leaves, I'd like to answer his question very quickly. Senator, I'd like to answer your question about how many cents per bottle this tax increase would add. I haven't done all the calculations, and I'm probably the worst person in the room to do the math, but what I can tell you is it'll be somewhere upwards of 50 cents at the first cut, but that will be multiplied by two or three times, and what it will do, and that's because it doubles at every level of distributorship or at distribution. What it will do is it will bounce wine out of its price point in the market, and that will cause small wineries to go out of business. So that's the answer to that earlier question.
The answer was 50 cents, but it'll be multiplied through and might come out to be $1.50 or $2.
Exactly. It'll be somewhere 43, 45, something like that, but it'll be multiplied. By the time it gets to the consumer buying the bottle of wine in retail, it will bounce that bottle of wine out of its price point, and that's a very delicate balance for the small wineries.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll just go over three main points today. The Wine Institute is opposing this proposed increase in the wine tax. It just has too severe an impact on the small growers. And as I was saying, most of the wineries in California are family-owned agricultural operations. We also have some of the largest, but predominance of the small agricultural operations. Number one, this is not a consumption tax. It makes me squirm in my seat and want to jump up and down when staff presents it as a consumption tax. Consumption tax and the way proponents of it put it out as it's 10 cents a drink, 5 cents a drink. That's not true, and Mr. Romaine and the beer folks really explained that adequately about how this doubles at every level of distribution. So this is a tax. This is an excise tax that's charged on the production. And when the wine comes into the state, as soon as it's for sale in the state, then the out-of-state wineries pay that tax. The second point, it's really important to know that currently Oregon taxes are in the middle range. So if you see a list of the 50 states, the 67 cents a gallon Oregon tax is right in the middle. Occasionally, we've seen documents in other sessions, and I really want to thank staff for cleaning this up. There would be a document that would show Oregon wine tax very low in the 50 states. What was happening is Oregon's excise tax was being compared to all the other states that have an excise tax plus a sales tax. So when you compare just the excise taxes, Oregon's somewhere in the middle there. There, in 1990, there was a 529% increase at the federal level in the wine excise tax. So that was really difficult for the wineries to absorb. I know in the state of Washington, the sales went down by over 8% the year after that excise tax was in effect. And the percentage is a little hard to gauge, but it went up and down over the months. But it was definitely causing sales to go down. I don't have the figures for Oregon, though we could certainly research those. It's important to compare Oregon's taxes to the other wine-producing states. Oregon is one of the predominant states: California, Oregon, Washington, and New York. New York, the tax is 19 cents a gallon. California, 20 cents a gallon. These are the areas that Mr. Verneau and other wine growers in Oregon have to compete with for their prices. So Washington's a little bit higher.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Certainly.
The previous panel, and I won't have you speak for the previous panel. If they want to come up, feel free to. The testimony was the reason we have such a concentration of microbreweries in Oregon is because we're a low-tax state, which certainly anyone can understand. Now, for wine, we're kind of the middle of the nation, but yet we still have a high concentration. We're a large producer state. Why the dichotomy for the beer and for the wine?
Mr. Chairman, the Oregon wineries, when they're small, got a great benefit through the exemption, so they paid no tax. Mm-hmm. So the 40,000-gallon exemption, as we grew our businesses, we paid no state tax. And then once you went past the 40,000, then you only pay tax on the gallons above 40. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got a running start. Mm-hmm. We have Oregon has the number two. We're number two in the nation for a number of wineries. Mm-hmm. And it's really partly a reflection of our tax policies and what our tax policies enable us to do. The problem is once you step over that 100,000-gallon limit, you get clobbered. And that's why there's only about five of us above that 100,000-gallon limit.
Ones.
The rest of the folks are huddled down there where it's profitable.
Mm-hmm.
I had bigger ambitions.
We like that. We're glad you do.
For the record, Sandra Bishop, that is correct. Oregon is perceived as an incubator state, and there are also other states that have the same kind of break where if you're producing under a certain number of gallons, you get some sort of tax structure. The purpose of it is exactly what Mr. Bruno is saying, is to allow your winery to get going. It takes many years to plant grapes and get the business going. Just a couple other points. I really want to speak to the competitive disadvantage. Market share of foreign wine sold in Oregon has increased in the last, I think it's the last 6 years, from 6.1% to 12.5%. What's happening is that there is very serious pressure from foreign wines. So some of those wines are great. We all drink them. We all try them. But the reality is that they are capturing a lot of Oregon's business. And if you put this kind of an onerous tax increase on, you are simply playing into that excessive pressure from foreign government-subsidized wineries a lot of these wines are coming from countries where the land cost is very low, land regulations are much looser, the cost of producing is much, much lower. So you're getting a lot of wine coming into the country, and that is a dramatic increase from 6 to 12.5%. And that comes back to my point of price points. It is not possible for a winery to simply increase their price per bottle by a couple of points. You can't take a wine that's priced at $9.95 and push it to $10.09 or $10.19 because you will, in effect, push it into that next price point. So I would be more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bishop. Questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Renaud. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. That is all we have signed up. Colleagues, do you have questions for Senator Metzger?
I was just curious. You know, it's all we have signed up, so the assumption is there's nobody in the audience who supports the beer and wine tax. That's what I'm asking, because no one else is. Okay. I'd like to hear from somebody if they support this. And
I think this gentleman does also. He just entered the room.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, pinch hitting actually for Gordon Foltz. Our message is that when you say support this, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, what we support is an increase in the beer tax, but have it dedicated under the formula now to both public safety and health services that go to deal with the consequences of consumption of the product. I don't know if that answers your question,
no,
sir, but
no, I appreciate that. I just find it very interesting that, you know, people talk about it, but then they won't come up and testify, you know, in support of it. So,
yeah. Chair, Senator Metzger, we understood there was maybe a hearing tomorrow. We would do a better job tomorrow with someone else speaking.
Okay, all right. We'll come back to I think colleagues at 9 a.m. will post this again for hearing and then possible work session tomorrow. Senator Nelson.
That's okay. I'll wait till tomorrow. Thank you. I kind of want to know the answer to the questions before I ask it.
They trained you well. Thank you.
Okay.
Anyone else? Close public hearing on House Bill 2152 adjourned Senate Revenue.
You got your two wide receivers there.
Two wide receivers.